This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. I've got a second baseman who'd be better off with you. His peg to first is dubious. He can't hit much, it's true, but if you take him off my hands, I'll celebrate and holler. I'll also buy your center fielder, and I'll pay top dollar. I didn't actually hear that plea during baseball's recently concluded winter meetings in Dallas, Texas, but ESPN's Tim Kirkjian may have. He joins me now to discuss such matters as whither, if anywhere, Manny Ramirez of the Boston Red Sox and Barry Zito of the A's and Bobby Abreu of the Phillies. Tim, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thank you very much, Bill.
Why are teams hesitating to move big players so far?
I don't think, Bill, it's that teams are hesitant to move a player. There's a hesitancy on other teams to pick up that player. In Manny Ramirez's case, for instance, this is a great player, great offensive player, 122 RBIs on average the last 5 years for the Red Sox. However, he comes with some emotional baggage. He also costs you $57 million if you're going to pick up the rest of his contract. And you got to give up two, maybe even more, really good players to get him. And that's where, for instance, the California Anaheim, Los Angeles Angels, whatever they are, have balked because they're looking at Manny and they're saying, we could use him. But we're not giving up these two guys and we're not taking on that money. The Red Sox have to pick up a significant portion of the salary in order to trade Manny Ramirez. To which the Red Sox say, we're trading 140 RBIs. We're not going to pay for that. So that's why some of these big deals have not happened.
You sound like a front office guy, Tim. You got that. You got the whole tone down.
Well, there have been a lot of front office. I saw three front office guys in the last 4 days at the winter meetings, and I've never seen that look on their face in my life. They were completely just overwhelmed by all this. They were frustrated. They were depressed because they couldn't get done what they wanted to get done.
Tim, the team making the most moves this week was the Toronto Blue Jays, almost Yankee-esque in spending over $100 million on two pitchers. Does it make Toronto a contender in the American League East?
I think they're a contender on the outside. I still like the Yankees more than them, and I still like the Red Sox more than them because I still don't think they have enough punch in their lineup, although getting Lyle Overbay from Milwaukee certainly is going to help things. But there's no way around the fact that B.J. Ryan, their new closer, is demonstrably better than anything they had late in the game last year just because he can strike people out. And A.J. Burnett, despite his 49-50 lifetime record, is a very good starting pitcher, and behind Roy Halladay gives them a great 1-2 punch. So they're way better than they were last year, but I still think they're the third-best team in the American League East.
The Yankees did very little, except they did pick up the immortal Kyle Farnsworth, who sounds as if he should be presiding over a mansion somewhere in Cuddleby-on-Thorn or something instead of playing baseball. But anyways, George Steinbrenner stopped throwing around vats of money?
Well, I think his general manager has, Brian Cashman. This is what Brian Cashman has been warning all of us all along, that at some point they're going to stop doing this. They're going to stop going out and taking every prospect they have and trading them for, you know, veteran players who make a lot of money and maybe are on the downside of their career. Granted, the Yankees only have a couple of prospects to trade, but they're not going to do that. So their plan is, instead of going out and giving Johnny Damon a 7-year contract, they're going to hang on, they're going to play Bubba Crosby, at least for now, in center field, and they're not going to do typical Yankee things in the offseason, that is, outspend everyone.
Well, fortunately, there is still one team in New York that knows how to hemorrhage money, and that's the Mets. Have they improved their fortunes with all the spending they've done?
The Mets have gotten significantly better. Billy Wagner gives them what they didn't have last year, and that is a top-flight closer at the end of the game. They had to have that. And then Carlos Delgado gives them what they didn't have last year or the last 2 years, a first baseman with power. Thing is, they're not done yet. They're going to go get a second baseman. They're going to go get an eighth-inning relief pitcher, and then they're really going to be set for next year. And I think right now they're the best team in the NL East.
The winter meetings in the old days used to give us a funny story or two. You know, the White Sox setting up a table in the lobby with a sign saying open for business. Do we get any funny stories these days at the winter meetings?
You know, Bill, I wish I could say yes, but this is the problem. To be serious and to be honest, all the general managers are up in their suites these days. They got their cell phones, they got their Blackberries, got all their computers on, and that's where they hang out. The days of Paul Owens actually showing people how to slide properly into a base at 2 o'clock in the morning, inebriated in his street clothes, those days are long, long gone, okay? And I don't think they're ever coming back. The new breed of general manager is completely serious about what he's doing. He doesn't do business over a cocktail at 1 o'clock in the morning. He's up in his suite and he's really hard to find. I guarantee you, Bill, I didn't even see half of the general managers in baseball because they're holed up in their suites, and that's how they do their business. They call the other GM and say, come down to suite 200. That's where we are.
Roger Clemens is no longer an Astro, or he might be, unless he goes to Boston or New York or maybe somewhere else in Texas, or maybe he retires. Can you help me out with this?
Well, there are three options, Bill. Number one is retirement. He may play in this World Baseball Classic and then just call it a career. Or he might go play for the Houston Astros, but he can't play for them under baseball rules until May the 1st. Mm-hmm. And the only other option, the third option to me at least, is the Texas Rangers, which again, he's a big Texan, he's a big Texas guy, and if Tom Hicks, another UT graduate, goes to him and says, Roger, come do for us what you just did for the Astros last year, and we'll pay $18 million for 1 year. That is the third option. At this point, Bill, I wouldn't be surprised if Roger Clemens retired, and I think there's a much better chance of him retiring than signing with the Red Sox or the Yankees or anybody other than Houston or Texas.
Tim Kirkjian of ESPN and ESPN the Magazine has survived another week of Major League Baseball winter meetings. He is our regular baseball analyst here at Only a Game. Tim, thanks very much.
Thank you, Bill.
As the NFL playoff picture comes into focus, the 4-8 Arizona Cardinals are, as usual, a bit, well, blurry. While Cardinals offensive lineman Ian Allen would much prefer that his team head into the postseason, more time away from the gridiron will allow him to focus on another interest. He'll soon release a new CD featuring music of his own creation. Mark Moran of member station KJZZ in Phoenix recently lounged with the mountainous maestro, and he offers this profile.
Meeting Ian Allen is a bit like introducing yourself to a dreadlocked bulldozer. What you learn later about the 6'4", 310-pound offensive lineman is that he was a theater major in college, president of his high school French club, and a member of his high school marching band and orchestra. Since then, he's collected model cars, painted murals, and considers himself a serious musician.
I've always felt like doing things different. I've always been, I guess, more of an intellectual person.
Allen was cut from his high school basketball team and was talked into trying out for the football team by a coach who told him he was too big to be in band and orchestra. He spent 3 seasons protecting quarterback Drew Brees at Purdue. He's now with the NFL's Arizona Cardinals. But Allen's creative streak has only grown since he turned pro.
Sometimes I wish I could draw. I used to try to draw in my free time, and there's a couple things I could draw, but I used to love to, you know, you see people doodle and daddle and stuff. You know, that's their outlet, whereas my outlet is music. That's my creative thing that makes me feel comfortable when I make it, you know what I mean?
Allen is comfortable enough to have created his own Nova 53 record label and release his first album, Nova's Lounge, which includes 11 songs in a genre Allen calls lounge cafe music.
I learned how to, when I was in college, how you can compose your own music without needing to hire a whole band to put everything together. I'm proud of the fact that I can make the music and that I am a true musician. And, you know, sometimes I wonder, should I force the fact that I'm a football player to make things happen? But I really don't like to do it that way. I want to be respected as a true artist. I hummed this song for 3 months. I had made the chord, just the I played that chord and I listened to that thing. I played it. I made it sound. I made it repeat itself probably for about a 12-minute period. And so I took it, put a beat behind it, and listened to it in the car for about 3 months. Like, man, what can I do with this? Because I want this chord to this chord I want to play. You know what I'm saying? I want to make something with this. So I hummed it to myself, and then that's when I got the yeah, and then it just kind of takes you through a whole trip like that, and it also puts you in a zone of whatever. It kind of puts you in a zone of whatever kind of mindset you're feeling at that time. That's what it's about.
But Ian Allen seems to have no problem getting into a mindset that most musicians never have to, one that helps him do gridiron battle with some of the biggest, strongest human beings on Earth. In fact, he claims football, in turn, helps his creative effort.
When I'm on the football field, bouncing off and hitting people and everything like that, so when I get home, it motivates me to make something peaceful, to settle down from all the stuff that I thought about while I'm out there on the field playing the game. A nice rhythm, a nice beat, and the doom. It's real subtle. Everything is real subtle. That's why it's all blended together, real subtle. And the little weird sounding voice and everything is like just something to put you in another mindset rather than in a fight mode.
Ian, you mentioned your music is music to drive aimlessly to. Let's go for a drive.
Okay, let's do it. All right, here we are, getting inside the car, gearing to take a ride on Nova's Lounge. When you're driving in the car, it puts you in the mindset of driving through the city, driving downtown, or even if you're on the highway, let's say you're taking a long trip cross country, this can put you into that mindset, but it's more the main purpose is more for downtown driving, getting ready to go out to an opera or just going out to go have a couple of drinks with your friends.
But Ian Allen also has his sights set on the future. He's a family man now with an infant at home, and he wants to create more music.
My plan is to be a full-time musician and continue to make album after album after album, you know. Because football is not going to last forever. That's the thing, you know. I can't play football for 40 years, and when I'm done being an athlete, I'm always going to be a musician.
Ian Allen's CD, Nova's Lounge, will be available in stores on January 8th. For Only a Game, I'm Mark Moran in Phoenix.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, a final farewell to surfing foam. But first, when is a high school not a high school? How about when it doesn't provide students with teachers or classes? And when would anybody choose to attend such a school? How about when they needed 6 or 7 extra A's in order to achieve eligibility for a football scholarship? Duff Wilson of the New York Times joins me now to discuss the suddenly infamous University High School of Miami. Mr. Wilson co-wrote a recent examination of University High. Welcome to Only a Game.
Nice to be on, Bill. Thanks.
Of what does University High School in Miami consist?
It's a small office in a 3-story office building where they don't answer knocks at the door.
So, no teachers, no books, no library, no desks. Anything there in terms of learning materials?
It's basically a mailing operation where they take checks in the mail and they mail out little study guides to students so that they can get their high school diplomas quickly.
How does the state get involved? What about educational standards?
Well, the state of Florida has a law that's very clear that the state shall have no regulation over private schools whatsoever. That comes from the tradition and the power of the religious schools there in Florida, but it extends to all kinds of correspondence schools and any kind of fly-by-night operation. The state completely hands-off, the most hands-off of any state in the nation. And the NCAA has also gone way hands-off on private schools as well.
Did the young men who bought credits at University High School see what they were doing as a scam?
I don't know if they saw it as a scam. They saw it as their opportunity to get a college athletic scholarship.
Mm-hmm.
They saw it as a legal way in the state of Florida, because it was legal, apparently, to get the A's and B's they needed fast to get their grade point averages up. A lot of these players had been identified as outstanding athletes early in their lives, and so had a lot of help in their schoolwork as they went along in order to keep them on the playing field. This was probably just an extension of that.
So they'd had enough help to stay eligible in high school, but not enough to reach the requisite grade point average for a college scholarship.
Just barely eligible to play high school football, Bill. These were a lot of the best football players in Miami-Dade County, and they went along with grade averages of C, just above a 2 point, which will let you play high school ball, but it won't get you a university admission.
I can understand how football powers like Florida, Florida State, and Auburn, for example, might have accepted unqualified students who had gotten their grades through university high after a few weeks of looking through pamphlets. But what were Rutgers and Temple doing in that mix?
Rutgers and Temple are trying to improve their football teams, I guess. And they didn't look very hard at where those A's and B's were coming in the last weeks of a student's career in high school.
But how hard would you have to look at a transcript seeing that he was taking 5 courses in his high school and 7 more at university high in the same semester?
You don't have to look at all. It jumps off the page. And I think it's instructive. It's telling that none of these schools mentions in their media guides for their star football players now the real high school they graduated from. They don't mention university high school. They're ashamed of it. It's a correspondence school. It's not a real high school.
Before admitting Demetrius Morley, Tennessee sent its associate athletic director for compliance to investigate University High. He left the question of whether University High was legit up to his admissions department, and the admissions department decided it was the NCAA's job to figure out whether anything was wrong, and the NCAA says it leaves these determinations up to the high schools themselves. Who should have stepped out and said, hey, wait a minute, this is ridiculous?
Other people have suggested that the university admissions offices ought to pay attention to where this influx of A's and B's are coming from. On the other hand, the NCAA has University High School on its approved list of high schools in this country. And so admissions offices, you know, find it easy to pass the buck to the NCAA.
Well, that brings up another interesting question. How does one go about getting its mail order diploma mill on the approved list of the NCAA?
It's not too hard. You just have to have somebody, anybody, certify that your classes meet the high school level of instruction. Somebody has to certify that instruction is available and that the classes are bona fide. The NCAA never checks on this. They've done a complete about-face on their standards for high schools in the past 5 years. Before 2000, the NCAA was examining classes and curriculums. Before 2000, they didn't allow any credits from correspondence schools. Where now all correspondence school credits are fine, and it's up to the schools themselves to certify that they're providing adequate instruction.
The state of Florida has now opened an investigation of University High, but are there other places like University High operating where non-students are desperate for a way to sneak under the system's guidelines?
None that we know of or that we have found. It seems unique in a way. There are some high school basketball academies which bring in elite basketball players and help them with their instruction, but they actually have instruction in classes. University High School is just kind of a marginal correspondence school for older people that really has no classes. And these football players were out of place there in that correspondence school. And they may be unique in the nation because of the circumstances in Florida.
With Pete Thamel, Duff Wilson wrote about University High School for the New York Times. He spoke with me from NPR's New York Bureau. Mr. Wilson, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Bill, thank you.
One could hardly fault observers of high school and college sports for concluding that too many of today's student athletes fall squarely on the latter half of the hyphenation. But one successful nonprofit program says it doesn't have to be that way, and in fact is demonstrating that tennis, combined with intensive literacy training, can put the student back into the student-athlete equation. Only a Game's Monica Brady-Meyerov reports on a Boston-based extracurricular program called Tenacity.
Here you go. Here you go. Nice, perfect, Leticia. Keep swinging. Stopping right at the top. 11-year-old Letitia is in jeans and a short-sleeve shirt. Even though she's wearing tennis shoes, it doesn't look like she's ready to break a sweat. But she will be sweating soon.
What we're going to do now is as you go up, you're going to try to turn your wrist so that you hit the ball right on your strings, but you're still going to freeze right at the top.
Sixth graders are lined up behind the net hitting balls. Most of them have never held a tennis racket, so it's rare if the balls even make it across the net. These are 150 carefully chosen at-risk kids from Boston Public Middle Schools. Most are minorities and are from low-income families. Tenacity combines intensive academic support and tennis in an after-school and summer program. Sixth, seventh, and eighth graders sign a contract that they will practice tennis and spend an hour and a half in study three times a week for almost the entire school year. Andy Crane, program director of Tenacity, says they can't do one without the other.
Tennis is the hook. It's not our goal to develop tennis champions. We're trying to develop kids who will be ready to succeed in high school and hopefully play some high school tennis and do well academically.
Of the first 60 kids who joined Tenacity when it started 7 years ago, all are still in high school and planning to graduate. A large accomplishment when you consider the dropout rate for high schoolers in Boston is more than 20%. Tenacity president and co-founder Ned Ames says the program is demanding, but in visits to their homes, he stresses the importance of staying in it to kids and their parents.
Kids that make it through 2 or 3 years of our program are completely changed. And they have confidence, they understand the importance of academics, they've developed social skills, and they're ready and eager to move on to high school, and they're making smart choices.
There are similar tennis and academic programs in New York City, Philadelphia, Washington, D.C., and San Francisco. But according to the U.S. Tennis Association, Tenacity has established itself as a benchmark for tennis-based youth development.
The basketball courts in our neighborhood parks have steel chain-link nets. I like that.
A college volunteer reads aloud to a small group of students during the academic portion of Tenacity's after-school program. It's one of the ways Tenacity is building literacy skills, designed to help students develop positive attitudes towards reading and improve their grades in English. They also offer homework help. 13-year-old Eric Rauda is now in eighth grade. He says when he came to the program, he needed help.
In sixth grade, I didn't pay attention that much. I didn't do that good. I do my work now.
Beth Miller, senior research advisor at the National Institute on Out-of-School Time at Wellesley College, says national research shows that after-school programs that combine academics with sports help kids more than programs that only focus on academics.
It's very clear that a pure academic program is not best, even when we're looking at academic outcomes. And I think that's because a huge part of what makes kids achieve academically is not drill and skill, it's engagement and learning.
And sports do this well by developing relationships between young people and adults. Tenacity program director Andy Crane says tennis also teaches social skills.
You have to have patience. It takes time to learn how to do this. You have to be fair and honest. It's one of the few sports out there where you make the decisions about your opponent's shots, whether they're good or not. You have to have cooperation because you're playing A on a team and often you're playing B, you're playing doubles with another player.
Some kids who participated in Tenacity are having success on the courts as well. The best players are competing in Junior United States Tennis Association tournaments, and some Tenacity graduates have high rankings in New England. 13-year-old Saquon Gall is overweight and sweats profusely in jeans and a t-shirt as he runs around the court. He probably isn't on track to be a star tennis player, but he's benefited from the program.
It gives you things to do after school, and unless you get a workout. At the end of the day, your foot gonna be hurting, your muscles gonna be hurting, and other stuff like that.
And what about your brain, too, from all the literacy and homework you gotta do?
It's gonna be bugging out.
For Only a Game, I'm Monica Brady-Meyerov in Boston.
So what I'm gonna do, too, I'm gonna hold my racket right behind you. If you fall back, you're gonna fall right into my racket. So you don't want to be falling backwards, okay? There you go. Always heads up.
The phrase surfing craze conjures images of Woody's lurching down the Pacific Coast Highway under the weight of surfboards and shaggy California teens awash in the sounds of Dick Dale, the Surfaris, and the Beach Boys. Surfing craze might not bring to mind the name of Gordon Grubby Clark, although surf buffs consider him to be instrumental in the rise of surfing in the U.S., as well as controversial. On Monday, after 44 years in business as a supplier to surfboard makers, Gordon Grubby Clark ended production and sales from Clark Foam, his factory in Laguna Niguel, California. Joining me now on the line from San Juan Capistrano, just a short cutback from the former epicenter of the surfing foam industry, is Chris Morrow, editor of Surfer Magazine. Chris, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you, Bill.
Why did Clark Foam shut down?
Well, you know, for decades he's actually been facing sort of an increasing battle with local and state officials as far as the environmental issues and concerns with the formula and the recipe of his foam blanks. You know, when his factory went in 40 years ago, there wasn't much buildup anywhere near his factory. It was kind of out in the middle of nowhere. Now you have multi-million-dollar homes sitting right atop the bluff above him. You know, Orange County looks entirely different. The Clark Foam factory, frankly, it's a bit of a relic.
Well, I understand that there was a problem with some of the materials he was using. Why didn't he just opt for greener technologies and stay in business?
That's the big question everybody's asking him. In fact, you know, the surf world's been pestering him with that for a long time because he's had a virtual monopoly. There hasn't been a real viable alternative yet that's green, that people are basically sold on the performance capabilities. People weren't ready to switch over, the surfers themselves. But now, you know, the issue is being forced upon us, so people are actually seeing this as a really great opportunity to look for that.
Tell me a little bit about the history of Gordon Clark and his impact on the surfing industry.
He is the Howard Hughes of the surf industry. He was guarding some of the closest numbers as far as all these people who were trying to research demographics. There's no better way than to know exactly how many surfboards are sold, and he actually knew what that was, but he never, ever told anybody. But he's your classic 60s character who a lot of those guys went into business and became very wealthy, probably none more so than he did, because he started an empire.
Mr. Clark denied our request to interview him. He has said, for owning and operating Clark Foam, I may be looking at very large fines, civil lawsuits, and even time in prison. Mm-hmm. Is his legal situation really that dire?
You know, it depends who you talk to. He does have former employees who have chronic health problems. The thing about Grubby is that, you know, the factory that he built it from scratch, by hand himself, all the machinery, everything. These days, when you have various government officials and authorities coming in to look at things and going, hey, these aren't up to code, these aren't up to snuff, it's like that was his big complaint because that's always subject to interpretation. Like today, he's in compliance, but tomorrow, he may not be. And it's a big reason why he didn't just sell his company to somebody else, because he's still liable for that machinery and stuff like that if he just got rid of it.
In addition to being an observer of the surfing scene, you're a surfer yourself. Are you conflicted about the closure of Clark Foam?
Well, you know, it's so funny because there's so many angles. There's tragic parts of it, but there's optimistic parts. Here you have the death of another great manufacturing plant in the United States. Say what you will about his business practices and that, but he was somebody who produced an incredible product, and even the little guy could custom order a surfboard blank and have it delivered to his door in 2 weeks. That's the part we're going to miss, because now basically the writing on the wall is that these factories are going to be moved over to China. It's not going to be as good. It's not going to be as consumer-friendly. You know, there's a sense of loss. A lot of the shapers up and down the coast, on both coasts really, and globally, feel like it's, you know, it's almost like a death in the family.
Do you own one of these boards made with Clark Foam? And if so, are you concerned about the toxicity at this point?
It's definitely an environmental long-term impact kind of thing. And if you're somebody who lives outside the Clark Foam factory or in the neighborhood, I could see why you'd be concerned, because, you know, it's spitting out a river of foam with 365 days a year, you know, 24/7. But once you get the board and you're riding it and you're day-to-day user, it's not the first thing on your mind, and you don't really feel like there's a health hazard when you're sitting on your board out in the lineup.
Chris Morrow is the editor of Surfer Magazine. He joined me on the line from San Juan Capistrano, California. Chris, thank you very much for speaking with me.
No problem, Bill.
Surfing rivers and dancing in the stay the same. Each time we recall these circle memories.
For more on this week's stories, pictures from stories past and present, commentaries galore, and the opportunity to write email to us, check out our website, onlyagame.org. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston. Additional support comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Available at the Implant Dentistry Center at Bicon.com, BICON.com. And from the dairy farm families who own Cabot Creamery, five generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, on the web at Cabot Cheese.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, the biography of gold medal skier Bill Johnson. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
The time has come again to reveal prematurely the winner of the Heisman Trophy, and so I will pause now, and you can strike the annual radio pose. Nicely done. Why are there only... Oops, I'm sorry. It's harder when you get older, isn't it?
It's not easy to win the Heisman Trophy when you're over 50.
Why are there only three worthy candidates this time around?
Because the three worthy candidates are so much more worthy than everybody else, and Matt Leinart really doesn't even belong in the bunch. It's between Reggie Bush from Southern Cal and Vince Young from Texas. I think they're already up to the second G in Reggie Bush's name on the little plaque after the UCLA game. Vince Young, to me, is the most valuable player in college this year, but Reggie Bush is the best.
Elsewhere in college football, Gary Barnett, whom scandal and boorish behavior could not unseat, is out as head coach in Colorado. What did him in?
Well, what did him in was losing his last three games of this season by a combined 130-22, including allowing Vince Young in Texas to put up 70 on him in the Big 12 championship game. You can be crude and boorish and play academics like a handball, but if you give up your last three, 130-22, you will lose your job. No loss for the University of Colorado.
Texas coach Mack Brown solidified his reputation as an honest man by casting his vote for Southern California as the number one team in the country. Or do you think Coach Brown just wants to go into the national championship game as the underdog?
He's lulling them into a false sense of security. I guarantee you, knowing what I know about Texas football fans, that Mack Brown is getting roasted in Texas for having done what I believe is the right thing.
On the pro football front and at the front of pro football, NFL Commissioner Paul Tagliabue said this week that the league hopes that the New Orleans Saints can play at least some of the team's 2006 schedule in the Louisiana Superdome. Likely?
Well, not till the end of the season, certainly, which guarantees that you'll have games split between San Antonio and LSU and Baton Rouge again for most of next season. This also guarantees that the New Orleans Saints' crazy owner will be making a scene at least once or twice before any games get played in the Superdome. I'm still, from a very visceral place, wondering how you can possibly go in there and play sports again after what the Superdome has come to mean.
As entertainment at Super Bowl XL, the Rolling Stones will be joined by Detroit's own Stevie Wonder. This is after an outcry that Motor City musicians weren't being acknowledged, even though the game was being played there. Does Stevie Wonder still have anything to do with Detroit?
Well, I'm sure he does in a historical sense. I mean, bear in mind, it could have been worse. It could have been Ted Nugent.
Well, what about Smokey Robinson, Iggy and the Stooges, the MC5? I mean, the possibilities are
limitless.
Yes,
I think the NFL is notable for its historical ability to kick out the jam's mother.
I'm sure that you were surprised to learn this week that there are some concerns regarding German soccer fans.
No!
With the World Cup scheduled for Germany this summer. What's a German word for hooligan?
I believe it was Wehrmacht for a very long period in the last century.
I'm not sure we should go there, but
no,
they
are so concerned about these hooligans that they're not just arranging, you know, to have them followed and what they do every year they have a World Cup. They're inspecting the stadiums to make sure the structures can stand them.
By the way, all the wailing that you've been hearing from across the sea since Wednesday has been Manchester United supporters mourning the departure of their club from the European Championships at the hands of Benfica of Portugal. Have you any words of consolation for Man U fans?
Well, I mean, this is sort of like rooting for the Cowboys or Jeff Gordon or somebody, isn't it? The Man U fans that I've met are perfectly willing to gin up enough self-pity. They don't need mine.
The NBA Players Association has filed a grievance regarding on-court apparel this time. Time for a legal brief.
Sam or David, we made the pants too long. 13 players have been fined $10,000 apiece for wearing their shorts too long. I have only one question. Does David Stern ever watch ESPN Classic? Does he ever watch those games from the 70s? That's a really bad look. The longer the shorts, the better.
If you're tired and tense and you have to commute to on the train, the place to do it may be Munich. How do you like the Yuletide perks on the Munich rail line?
They're putting yoga instructors on the train. Now, I myself, back in my poor, struggling alternative journalist days when I didn't own a car here in Boston, would ride the Green Line MBTA train to and from work every day.
Mm-hmm.
And I can tell you that getting into the Arborway E-Train Green Line used to require me to adopt many positions beyond what you would expect from someone untrained in yoga. These include get your briefcase off my foot, don't drop that coffee in my lap, and I don't care who you are, take off the damn headphones and get off my foot!
And astonishingly, you probably didn't feel any more relaxed when you reached your destination.
Oddly enough, I did not find the bliss. I think that was on the Orange Line.
Charlie, when Gary Boswell and Greg Thornock each finished with 137 votes in the city council election in Eureka, Utah, they turned to games to break the tie. Good idea?
They cut cards, or they had cards cut for them, and Gary Boswell drew the Queen of Diamonds, beating Greg Thornock 7 of clubs, and now we have Counselor Boswell in Eureka. And all I can think of is Lawrence Harvey in The Manchurian Candidate.
Ooh.
How about a nice game of solitaire? Remember what the key card was?
Serious consequences in that.
If I were Greg Thornock, I'd be locking my door right now.
My candidate for Name of the Week is Scott Speed, and I'm sure it will surprise nobody to learn that he is the first American to compete as an F1 driver since 1993. Recognizing that this is terra incognita for Mr. NASCAR, I ask you, has Mr. Speed got anything going for him beyond the moniker?
Actually, it's not unprecedented, because when I became Mr. NASCAR was when I wrote a piece about NASCAR. And the person I hung out with was the driver of the spam car, whose name was Lake Speed.
Ooh.
And all I can say is that Scott Speed and Lake Speed have it all over, say, oh, I don't know, Dick Trickle.
And finally, Charlie, since we're only a week away from our 13th annual sports holiday gift guide, I ask you, has anyone yet gotten a cooler sports present than Pope Benedict XVI got this week?
Yes, he got a steering wheel from Michael Schumacher's title-winning car, is bearing the inscription, the Formula One World Champion Steering Wheel to His Holiness Benedict XVI, Christianity's Driver. Now, that's not altogether true. 300 or 400 years of history have demonstrated us. I just hope that the Pope doesn't do what he does with all round things and wear it around his neck.
Charlie Pierce, hell on wheels, even when he's idling, writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Yesterday afternoon in Germany, amid much pomp and anticipation, the draw for the 2006 World Cup transpired. The U.S., unseeded in the tournament, find themselves in Group E. Bruce Arena's team will have to finish first or second in the group that also includes Italy, Ghana, and the Czech Republic in order to advance in the tournament. The U.S. will begin play on Monday, June 12th at Gelsenkirchen against the Czech Republic. The World Cup final will get underway when Germany hosts Costa Rica on June 9th in Munich. In January 1984, Bill Johnson became the first American skier to finish first in a World Cup downhill race. A month later, at Sarajevo, he won an Olympic gold medal. When asked shortly after that race what winning meant to him, Johnson smiled and said, "Millions. We're talking millions." 16 years later, having confessed that he was bored and broke and that he just wanted to have some fun, Johnson, aged 40, tried to make a comeback. That effort ended in a horrific crash that resulted in brain damage. In Ski to Die, Jennifer Woodleaf tells the story of Bill Johnson's improbable rise to ski champion and the consequence of his attempt to recapture the glory he'd known as an Olympian. Jennifer Woodleaf joins me now from KQED in San Francisco. Jennifer, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you.
Johnson was an on-again, off-again member of the U.S. ski team for years, and there's one story of his days with the team that I found especially poignant. It has to do with a night that he stayed out past curfew, and then he tried to sneak back into the dormitory, and none of his teammates would help him?
They wouldn't. They pretty much had a love-hate relationship with Bill. He was not let back in. They weren't going to help him out, having missed his curfew. He had to scale a fire escape and bang on windows and kept peeking into everybody's rooms. Nobody was going to let him in. Finally, he got a manager to let him in, and the team ended up finding out about it. Bill made his own bed to some extent. To start with, he was sort of a poor kid, a little bit from the wrong side of the tracks. It was a pretty wealthy elite sport. But he did his own part in making sure he alienated people, perhaps before they alienated him first. But he would show up in a room and say, "Once I'm done skiing, nobody's going to remember any of you, only me."
That would do it.
Yeah. That will do it.
Johnson, his mother and father, and various people around him assumed that he would have it made after he won at Sarajevo. He had, after all, been the first American to win a gold in downhill. Why didn't it work out that way?
I think part of it was that he was so brash at predicting his victory and announcing that it would mean millions to him that he wasn't necessarily the picture of sportsmanship that sponsors were looking for, especially in terms of an Olympic athlete. Probably a little more wholesome and good, a good team player was probably more what they wanted to put in a Wheaties box at that time.
When he tried to come back as a world-class skier 11 years after retiring from the sport, Bill Johnson was racing against the sons and nephews of his former competitors. What did they think about this effort?
Well, a lot of them respected him and what he had done in the past, but they didn't respect what he was doing here. It was a really wide range of reactions to his comeback. The best that you could say was some people said if it was Bill Johnson, you could never count him out. Most people thought it was an incredible long shot, and a lot of people thought he was crazy and were actually laughing at him to some extent.
Bill Johnson raced competitively for the last time in March of 2001 in Montana in a race that he was very much hoping he would win in order to pile up points to be considered perhaps for the next Olympics. Describe the accident that ended his career.
Bill was going about 70 miles an hour at the time on new parabolic skis that he was not very familiar with, that it was the first time he was racing on them. He took a corner in a section of the course called Corkscrew on the downhill at Big Mountain in Montana. He hit the icy mountain face first and basically flipped. What happened was his brain rotated inside his skull. The removal from the mountain was absolutely flawless. It was the most incredible recovery possible. The rescue helicopter was available. It was good enough weather for it to land. It wasn't off on another call. It was immediately there. There was a doctor on course who was a volunteer who was educated at Yale who was at his side within moments. His life was saved on the mountain once. It was saved outside of the helicopter again. When they got him to the hospital in Kalispell, he was saved by a doctor first in the emergency room, then again on the operating table. The one brain surgeon in that hospital happened to be on duty and in the hospital at the time, not in another surgery. The series of events, in many respects, he should have died. It was just another one of the amazing aspects of Bill's life that he did, in fact, survive the accident.
You got your title, Ski to Die, from the philosophy Johnson espouses, and it was also a philosophy that he had tattooed on his right bicep. Among those who've said Bill might have been better off dying than surviving the crash in 2001 is his mother. Were you surprised that at least sometimes she feels that way?
I think it's an incredible burden on her to care for him, but most importantly, I think Bill himself feels that way most of the time. That had he had a choice to die in Montana, that's the way he would have chosen. Physically, he's in pretty good shape now. He's back on skis. Mentally, he's not necessarily all there all the time. He'll make comments frequently such as, what were the price of stamps back when I was alive? Mm. So he's aware things have changed.
The story of Bill Johnson after his accident is exceptional. One manifestation of the brain damage that he suffered is that he doesn't remember painful experiences, such as the accident itself. He doesn't remember being divorced. He was surprised when he left the hospital that his wife didn't take him home. His estrangement from his mother, again, another absent part of his memory. What does he remember?
He remembers the good times. Which is, if you can find a silver lining to his accident, it's that. He lost pretty much about the last 6 to 10 years prior to his accident. And in those years, as you said, his wife left him. He had a son drowned in the family hot tub while he was at home. He had an estrangement with his mom. His dad died. He lost his way. He floundered around trying to find something else to do and ultimately settled on this comeback. All of that for him is gone. So back in his mind, he's back in the days when he was happy and married and on the ski team and had won a gold medal.
Beyond that, what is his life like today, sort of on a day-to-day basis?
It's a pretty quiet life. He lives in a trailer outside of Portland, Oregon. He has some friends nearby and some family. He sees two sons that live in Sonoma, California. He has visitation with them. They live with his ex-wife. He skis, certainly, almost year-round. He does some events, some brain injury associations he speaks at. He tends to his vegetable garden. It's a quieter life than he was used to in the past.
The people who know Bill Johnson best, his former wife, his mother, his former teammates, his friends, both former and current, were exceptionally candid with you when you did this book. How have they responded to what you've produced?
I think, by and large, they are happy that it wasn't sort of a puff piece, a glossing over, strictly an inspirational story, because there's a lot there to Bill's life as far as him being tortured and conflicted and the extremes of his life, winning a gold medal, coming out of nowhere to do that, and then a few years later having a baby die in a tragic accident. He's just had so many highs and lows, and I did my best to portray it in the book as a true American tragedy and the cost of chasing dreams. I think his friends have responded to that. They certainly, some of his competitors and his opponents have said things to me, and even his teammates, when I was researching the book, that they didn't like Bill at the time. They don't have anything nice to say about him. And now that he is the way he is, nothing feels good about trashing him. And so they don't really have anything to say. But I was able to draw them out. I did about 200 interviews on the book. It was challenging with the subject being brain damage to have to fill in all the gaps, but I got an incredible amount of cooperation, and the book is all the better for it.
Jennifer Woodleaf is the author of Ski to Die, The Bill Johnson Story, published by Emmis Books. She joined me from the studios of KQED in San Francisco. Jennifer, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Greg Fazio and from Howard Gilman at KQED in San Francisco and Manoli Wetherill at NPR's New York Bureau. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to learn more about Ski to Die, browse Only a Game show archive, or sign up for our newsletter, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from Charlie Pierce, who gives us one more Heisman pose to carry us till next December. Now that's good radio. You can almost hear the leather helmet and complete lack of face mask. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, from NPR member stations, From the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from vision to innovative impact, 75 years of philanthropy, on the web at wkkf.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.